Okay, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Larkin, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you very much and good morning to this Zoom argument on January 12, 2023. We have four cases. Our first case, as you're aware, we're doing this by Zoom. So while we have parties who can obviously observing, I just want to make clear that there is going to be a recording of this Zoom argument, an audio recording, but no one can make their own recordings. So our first case is 822-1188, if I pronounce this correctly, Russell Stuckrath versus Charles Stuckrath et al. So as counsel are aware, appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument. Chief, respondent will have 15 minutes of rebuttal, and then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes left to sum up. So, counsel for the appellant, if you're ready, if you could just tell us who you are, please, and you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Douglas Kluver, and I represent the appellant, Ivan Stuckrath, in this matter. The issues that are before the court are basically two issues. The first issue is when the sibling is exactly when did the sibling liens attach it that were found in the deed. And the second issue is whether the court properly granted reformation of the deed. And even more specifically, the deed was reformed to include taking into account a capital gains obligation on the part of the grantee rather than simply the income taxes. So I think that in our brief, the issues I think are pretty narrow. They're fairly straightforward. I don't think I have much to add in addition to the brief than what we've already had. So I think that we would stand on the briefing that we did today unless the court had any questions for me.
I think Judge Larkin has a question, Mr. Kluver.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Kluver. So what I'd like to confirm with you is from my reading of your brief, it seems that as to the first issue, your legal argument is the deed was not ambiguous. The district court should not have had a trial on the basis of ambiguity in an attempt to resolve said ambiguity. You say that the language of the deed is clear and should not have been found ambiguous, correct?
Correct.
So then I don't see then, you know, an argument that, well, and in resolving that issue, the district court erred in concluding that this is when the liens attached.
I guess I'm not following.
Well, I think there's two potential issues here. One, you identify did the district court err in finding the deed ambiguous and holding a trial to determine how to resolve that ambiguity based on the intent of the parties? So that's the issue you raise, yes?
Yes.
Okay. I don't then see in your briefs a second issue, an alternative argument, and, you know, to the extent it was ambiguous, the district court erred in resolving that ambiguity in the way it did.
Well, there was, I see what the court's saying. And perhaps that should have been a secondary issue. But essentially what we're saying is there was no ambiguity here that these liens attached initially.
Understood.
At the inception. Right. And so there was no need to have ability for the court to allow for parole evidence because there was a misinterpret of that deed. There was
On the second issue, I understand your argument to be the district court erred in granting reformation, and your arguments as to why that was error have to do with the procedure that the district court used. In other words, the district court didn't receive additional hearing, didn't give you an opportunity to make arguments, that sort of thing. Is that the gist of your second argument?
That is the gist of the second argument. Obviously, it's somewhat tied to the first argument in that there was no ambiguity in that a deed initially.
Let me ask you this, and I'm not a tax attorney, never was, but mm-hmm. aren't capital gains taxes part of a person's income taxes? I mean, don't you file a capital gains schedule when you file your income taxes?
Capital gains. There certainly could be that argument, and I think that there should have been that argument one way or the other, and there should have been an opportunity to make that argument. But when a party comes in and they are asking for equitable relief, and like in this case, there was no motion. There was nothing brought before the court. There was simply a mention of it in a closing argument. The court ordered an evidentiary hearing, and there were issues with getting the discovery that was necessary. But Mr. Stuckrath, Charles Stuckrath, who had the property, had the benefit of this property, and still, even as we were here today, still gets income off of this property. And then to turn around and say, I want my siblings to pay my capital gains tax, even though I haven't shared any income with them all the way along. It seems like that is an equitable issue that the court should have listened to and should have taken evidence regarding that issue. And that's why we're saying that there was never procedurally it was wrong. And probably the result may have been wrong too.
Thank you for clarifying that. I think I understand the arguments in your brief very well.
Mr. Kluver, can I go back to the first issue? I'll be honest with you, speaking for myself, I don't know that I could have created a more ambiguous paragraph than I see here. And the judge had I'll use loosely, perhaps the benefit of the drafting attorney. Seemed to be going back and forth as to what it meant as it related to the sale of the 60 acres and whether the lien attached or not. But it seems like, so I'm going to ask you to maybe help me out a little bit. And I'm focusing, because it seems like you were focusing on that last sentence, the subordination language to any mortgage which grantee may place upon the above described property during the life of the grantors and the survivors of them. And you'll have to help explain to me why that couldn't still reasonably be ambiguous in terms of when it attaches, because you've got that 5-year post death period. So the lien could have, the initial mortgage could have arose during the life of the grantor, but it also would remain on there for the 5-year period thereafter. And so yet the subordination clause itself doesn't tell us when these liens attach, but simply that they are subordinate to any liens that were previously on the property. And so that includes the 5 years after the grantor and the survivor of the grantor is deceased. Am I correct? And so help me understand how that to you is so obviously makes it attach earlier than that.
Right. Well, these liens, What I'm trying to get at is when did the clearly from the language they said that the property was granted to Charles, subject to liens in favor each of the following named persons. So clearly that puts a lien on it. Now there's you can argue that the liens didn't attach immediately. I'm not really clear where that argument comes from. This clearly says that it's subject to liens in favor of them. And then it goes on even to say that there's this subordination language that subordinates subsequent mortgages or liens that may be attached to the property. So ultimately, I'm saying there's nothing in here that says these liens don't attach immediately. There's nothing ambiguous about any of this as far as when the liens attach. There's nothing, simply nothing that says these liens attach later. And the subordination clause actually just backs that up further, that there'd be no need to subordinate mortgages if these liens weren't already attached to this property. And that's consistent with what we know about estate planning. The one thing that it seems the parents wanted was the property to go to Charles so that they could protect it after the look back period from a nursing home lien or something like that. And in order to protect the other siblings, they placed the liens on there, which is a pretty common practice, because there's no restriction on Charles here selling this property. He could sell it anytime he wanted. He just couldn't sell it that without being subject to those liens. And so that's why I think that this is not ambiguous. There is some language in there regarding the sale, of the procedure for the sale, and how that will be, how that valuation may occur. And there could be some argument with that, but argument as to when these liens attach, it seems to me by this four corners of this document, these liens attached immediately.
And can I follow up an answer you provided to Judge Larkin about the reformation, the second issue? Isn't it true, if I read the record correctly, that the judge scheduled an evidentiary hearing to allow your client to present evidence as it relates to the relief, all the relief that had been reserved, one of which was reformation, as I understand it, from the judge's order, but your client chose not to present any evidence?
Now, that wasn't at all what happened in this case. What happened, the judge also allowed for discovery. And what happened was the Charles Stuckrath refused to provide the discovery, which was just simply the income off of the farm for the past 14 years. And the judge said in that decision that, well, since he had provided check registers at some point back in the proceeding, he didn't have to provide that. And that's what happened at the date that was set for the evidentiary hearing. There was no evidence taken in this case. There was, Charles Stokra has the burden of proof in this type of proceeding. It's improper to argue that, well, you didn't put in enough evidence. Or you didn't put in evidence when Charles Stuckrath didn't put in any evidence either, because there was not an evidentiary hearing held for the reformation.
Once the judge denied your request for compelled discovery, did you then indicate to the judge you desired to schedule the matter for further evidentiary hearing?
Well, the court simply, that issue never came up. I guess we never held the evidentiary hearing. And what happened was, I didn't know what was going on with it. I suspected we would have the evidentiary hearing, in which I sent a letter to Mr. Saunders and said, hey, aren't we going to have an evidentiary hearing? To which Mr. Saunders responded with his letter and a proposed order, which the judge signed without just signed a proposed order that came without requesting a proposed order. In fact, the judge never even changed the caption that said proposed order. And there's no indication to me that the judge even read that order. That was simply signed because it was submitted.
Okay, but then you did file a motion for new trials and amended findings after that order?
We did.
But that was denied as untimely, and you're not challenging that as error?
We're not.
Right.
So if there's nothing further, then I would yield the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is John Saunders from the law firm of Anderson Larson, and I represent Charles Stuckrath. Procedurally, there's no transcript was ordered by the appellant, and so the court is restricted to determining whether the findings of fact are supportive of the conclusions of law. I have to maybe start at the end of the discussion, which is there was an evident final argument where the evidence was detailed to the judge that was presented at the original trial concerning reformation. The judge rightly allowed for an evidentiary hearing and any discovery that was necessary, and he set an evidentiary hearing, and we had that evidentiary hearing. The evidence of Charles Stuckrath was placed in at the trial, was tried by acquiescence of all parties, and then the appellant was given the opportunity to come to that evidentiary hearing. It was held. We had it. All the appellant argued about was the discovery. And our position on the discovery was he's never relayed the nexus between what that discovery would have provided him as a defense to the Reformation. He wants to talk about the income. As stated in my brief and in the findings, multiple check registers, bank statements, loan statements, they were all into evidence. In fact, I told counsel for appellant, just look at the record, and I gave him the trial exhibits to look at the information he was looking for. Discovery he could have done was other siblings who would dispute what Michael and Roy and Charles were saying about what their mother wanted. Their mother knew that if they ever needed that property sold to pay for their nursing home care, this family would never agree. And I think that's shown by our appeal, our multiple trials. We're coming up on the 5-year anniversary of this lawsuit. And at every level, it's been disputed by one or more of the siblings. And so the evidence that was presented at trial was, in fact, that Margaret Stuckrath, the mother, knew that this would occur. And therefore, she wanted 5 years for the family to come together and decide what to happen to the property. And at the conclusion of that 5 years, this lawsuit was brought. And so we believe that in the original trial, all the evidence necessary for the court to determine reformation was present. The appellant was given an opportunity to argue about that in an evidentiary hearing, chose not to. Then I sent the letter to the court. The appellant didn't request a continuance, didn't request further hearings. There's nothing in the record that says he was unwilling to have that be the order, and the court issued the order. And so reformation, I believe, is clear. The appellant had an opportunity, chose not to use it.
Mr. Saunders, could you, just as an example, what sort of evidence was litigated during the trial regarding allocation of the capital gains tax prior? If I understand the reformation now, that will be paid, that'd be shared by everyone essentially as part of the expense of the sale. Can you use that? Would that might give me a little flavor of the sort of evidence that was presented during the trial?
Yeah, I've never really understood the argument of the appellant on this. Under tax law, if Charles Stuckrath was deeded the property, he takes it at the basis of his parents, which means if they bought it for $1,000 an acre, that's their basis. If Charles sells it for $10,000 an acre, he's going to have $9,000 of gain. And according to the deed, he's to distribute 1/7 out to each of his siblings. If they don't share in that capital gains, because Charles Stuckrath is the sole owner, he's going to get a 1099 for that capital gains. And so Mr. Torvik correctly put in the deed that all of the parties, that first of all, we have to pay any mortgages. Then we have to pay the income tax, and then we divide it 7 ways, which is the only fair way to do this. The fact that Mr. Stuckrath has been getting the income and paying the taxes on that is unrelated to the capital gains generated on the sale. If all the parties are going to share in that sale proceeds, they all have to share in the capital gains. It was thought about previously in the deed. For some reason, I think the appellant is making some distinction between income taxes. I think Judge Larkin is 100% correct. You pay capital gains as part of your income tax. You know, there's tax on your income, there's capital gains. But in Mr. Torvik's mind, he was saying, you know, there is no other tax that's generated on the sale of the property. It's only capital gains tax.
I have a question.
Yes.
Why was reformation necessary? That's what I kept wondering. Because once the district court has the trial, figures out what the party's intent was, and says, here's how this is going to go, why was it necessary to reform the deed? Wasn't that order good enough to direct the party's actions going forward?
Here's the problem, Your Honor. It said that Charles Stuckrath had to sell the land within 180 days of the last parent to die, or he had to pay the liens in 5 years. And the testimony that came out to trial is that's not what Mom wanted. Mom wanted him to try and get this family to agree on the disposition for 5 years. And at that point, it could be sold and distributed in sevenths. Charles Stuckrath is a Social Security recipient. He's disabled. There's no way he's going to be able to buy $1.2 million worth of land at the end of 5 years. That was never the intent of Charles, never the intent of his parents. They wanted him to try, and that came out through the testimony of Roy, which would have been against his interest. Yep.
And my question is just from my own understanding. It seems like what the district court ordered says that. And so why isn't that order good enough to go forward? Or is it just cleaner to reform the deed to reflect the order so there's no confusion by any outside parties or any purchasers?
I think that's the most important thing. As you can see,
clean title.
As you can see, the appellant's already arguing about whether taxes come out. And so I think it was a clarification of the evidence presented and how this would all work. We believe the property should be sold, the mortgage paid, the taxes paid, and it distributed in sevenths. And I don't think that was entirely clear, as we can see by the appellant's arguments today. Unless there are other questions, I would defer my time.
Seeing none, Mr. Kluver, you'll have the last word, sir. You're muted, Mr. Kluver. You've got to unmute.
Sorry. The procedures that are in place by rule and are important, and they're there for a reason, and we can ignore them and just move forward. But as laid out in our brief, there's procedures for a reformation. For a proper reformation, there has to be a prima facie case made and a finding regarding that. That just simply didn't happen in this case. And so I do not believe that the reformation was proper. Regarding the lien interests, the court is confined to a de novo look at the deed itself and to make a determination as to whether there was whether the liens that were put on here, where there was an ambiguity as to when the liens would attach. My clients argue that there was no ambiguity. The liens attached immediately, and that should have been what the court concluded. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within 90 days.